When I hear that passage in Luke, I automatically think of two places that I'm familiar with where I see something a lot like what is described there, a structure that began to be built that was never finished. There's one that's a hotel, I believe, is being built right off of I-75 at the exit to my parents' house between Gainesville and Lake City. I don't know if you've ever noticed it. It's off to the right as you're heading north. It looks like they got to a really good start, and I don't know what happened. I don't know if it was in the middle of the market collapse or what, but it was never finished. I'm not quite sure why they thought they needed a big, nice hotel there to begin with. But they began building and were not able to finish for one reason or another. There's another place on the way to my grandparents' house. It looks like a very nice subdivision. A little line of condos was going to be built there. And they have streets all laid out and street lamps up here and there and one row of condos built and nothing else on the rest of those streets. And for whatever reason, they were not able to complete that. But every time I drive by one of those places, it strikes me that here is a promising start that was never finished. And whatever the reason may be, however good it may be, the reality is it's a promising start that was never finished. And how much worse it is when it is a start into faith that was never finished. There are a few things that bother me more than dishonest salesmen. I'm sure you've run into people along those lines that will emphasize all of the positive aspects of something, and as soon as you get it home, all you can see are all the negative aspects of it, and you can't see those positives anymore at all. Or perhaps they'll engage in that old bait and switch where they'll promise one thing and deliver another, or maybe they'll just come right out and lie to you about something. And it's about the worst thing imaginable, at least in my experience, pretty high up on that list. I wonder sometimes if we do any better when we are teaching the gospel. How many half-built structures are out there because we've not emphasized the cost of discipleship? We tell them the yoke is easy. We tell them that heaven is wonderful, and all of those things are true and rightfully so. I mean, they should be emphasized. But not at the expense of the fullness of the truth that there is a cost in discipleship. I grew up in the church. I've been a Christian for more than 20 years now of my life. I've heard a variety of preachers preach the gospel and offer invitations. I've seen plans of salvation, whether they're five step or five plus one or something else. But I've only known one preacher in my life who regularly, continually emphasized counting the cost of discipleship. Why is that? Why are we afraid that we're going to scare them off and we're never going to get them under that water to begin with? Is it just the nature that of people that we don't want to emphasize the negative side of things? We only want to emphasize the positive? Whatever it may be, Jesus was very clear on this issue. There is a cost in discipleship. It costs a whole lot to become a disciple of His. You think about the scripture that was read just for us by Grant, or the parallel text in Matthew chapter 10 that we'll be looking at in some more detail today. You think about the story of the rich young ruler where there's this young man who runs to Jesus and asks what he needs to do to be saved. And Jesus tells him to give away everything that he has. You think of the Sermon on the Mount and the hard teachings that are found there, or John 6 and the hard teaching that is found there that drove people away. Jesus is clear on this issue. There is a cost of discipleship, and you better know what it is before you get involved. Because it's not cheap. And if you begin down that path, you better be ready to finish that journey. Jesus met a lot of half-hearted people that weren't willing to make a commitment to follow Him. And He exposed those people for half-hearted people that weren't ready to make a commitment to follow Him. He turned away people that were unwilling to pay the price. And in our preaching of the gospel, we need to be just as clear and transparent on this issue as Jesus was. We need to be ready to turn away people who are not willing to pay the price of discipleship, because that is what our Lord did. I was doing some reading on this passage and came across a quote. I posted it the other day. You may have already seen it if you happen to see that. But it's striking to me. This author said the Christian landscape is strewn with the wreckage of derelict half-built towers, the ruins of those who began to build and were unable to finish. For thousands of people still ignore Christ's warning and undertake to follow Him without first pausing to reflect on the cost of doing so. The result is the great scandal of Christendom today, so-called nominal Christianity. In countries to which Christian civilization has spread, large numbers of people have covered themselves with a decent but thin veneer of Christianity. They've allowed themselves to become somewhat involved, enough to be respectable, but not enough to be uncomfortable. Their religion is a great soft cushion. It protects them from the hard unpleasantness of life while changing its place and shape to suit their convenience. No wonder the cynics speak of hypocrites in the church and dismiss religion as escapism. And I think he's absolutely right. If we're not truly committed to Christ, if we're not really willing to pay the cost of discipleship, if we just wear Christianity as a badge and as a name, the world's going to look at us and say, yeah, they're a bunch of hypocrites. Because in reality, that's what we are if we're not paying the cost of discipleship. Christianity is not some kind of, you know, fire insurance against hell where we purchase it and try to keep our policy from lapsing. That's not what Christianity is about. It is a complete dedication to follow a crucified Christ. And we need to make sure that that's what we preach, and we need to make sure that that's who we are. It is full commitment to Him without ever knowingly holding anything back from Him. It's certainly not just an agreement with a list of facts that we happen to, you know, we think that sounds pretty good. We'll agree with that. It's a whole life that is dedicated to Christ. And as clearly as anywhere in the Gospels, in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus makes it clear what the cost of discipleship is. We'll look at verses 32 through 39. We'll pick up some of the context before that as well along the way. But we'll focus primarily on these verses. Matthew chapter 10, beginning in verse 32. Jesus says, "Everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will deny before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a person's enemies will be those of his own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." Well, what is the cost of discipleship here in Matthew chapter 10? Well, it begins with this idea of confessing Christ before others. Well, what is confession? This is one of those religious words we use a lot. We've heard it a lot, but we don't often stop to talk and ask, you know, what it is. Well, it's a very simple idea, and I don't think it's anything that you're not aware of already. It's simply to affirm or acknowledge or agree with something. It's a statement of identification or faith or confidence or trust in someone. It is done by mouth, as Paul says in Romans chapter 10. But maybe more significant than that even, it's done by deed. In Titus chapter 1, for example, Titus chapter 1, Paul talks about those who are confessing by mouth, but they're really confessing something else in how they act. Titus chapter 1 and verse 16, they profess to know God. They are confessing God, Paul says. They profess to know God, but they deny Him by their works. They are detestable, disobedient, unfit for any good work. And so those people, they say one thing, but they're not really confessing God. And so you confess with your mouth on the one hand, but you confess with your life as well. And the result of confession is pretty clear. Romans 10, you know, verses 9 and 10, you confess with your mouth, you'll be saved. Matthew chapter 10, we just looked at, if you confess Him, He'll confess you. 1 John chapter 4, if you confess God will abide in you and you will abide in God. And so it all points to this picture of salvation. This is a very important thing. What we miss very often when we talk about confession, and particularly in this verse in Matthew chapter 10, is the larger context of what Jesus is talking about here. We talk about confessing before men, and what we think about when we read this verse, primarily, at least in my experience, what we think about is what we do here at the church building. When someone comes forward and they want to be baptized, they confess Jesus before men, and that is before those who are here. And that's a good and right and proper thing to do, obviously, but that's not what Jesus is talking about here. If you put it in its full context, it becomes pretty clear that Jesus is talking about something a little bit more dangerous than that. Beginning back in verse 16, Jesus is about to send his apostles out. And he says, "Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Beware of men, for they will deliver you over to courts and flog you in their synagogues. And you'll be dragged before governors and kings for my sake, to bear witness before them and the Gentiles. When they deliver you over, do not be anxious how you are to speak or what you are to say, for what you are to say you will be given in that hour. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. Brother will deliver brother over to death, and father his child. And the children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in one town, flee to the next. For truly I say to you, you will not have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for the disciple to be like his teacher and the servant like his master. If they've called the master of the house Beelzebul, how much worse will they malign those of his household? So have no fear of them, for nothing is covered that will not be revealed or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the dark, say in the light, and what you hear whispered, proclaim on the housetops. And do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. But even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven." These two verses about confession are very clearly set in the context of disciples preaching the gospel and being persecuted and being killed for what they are doing. You're going to go out into the world and you are going to be attacked. You are going to be betrayed by people you love the most. The government will come after you. The Jewish religion will come after you. Your own family will come after you. Standing up for Jesus is not here set in the context of that, being ashamed, meaning, you're embarrassed because it's not popular to talk about Jesus. That's not what he's talking about here. What he's talking about is denying Christ or confessing Christ in the context of persecution and even death. And ultimately then, what confession means in this context is trusting God. It's not just saying words, although it is that as well. It's looking at the sword and saying, "I might die, but my ultimate confidence is not in this life. My ultimate confidence is in Christ." Notice in verses 26 through 31, Jesus will say three times, "Don't be afraid. Don't fear." It might be significant that he says it three times in that short of a context. In verses 26 and 27, he first says, "Have no fear of them." And the reason why is because everything is going to be revealed. Everything that is hidden is going to be revealed, which is simply to say that ultimately the truth is going to triumph. Whatever they are doing, whatever they are after, that's going to be exposed for what it is. And as the disciples take this teaching that Jesus has given them and teach it publicly, the truth is going to be revealed and the truth is going to be victorious. And the question is, can you trust that when you are looking death in the eye? Can you trust God that the truth will be victorious when your life hangs in the balance? Verse 28, he will say again, "Do not fear. Don't fear those who kill the body, but have no power over the soul." Basically, don't fear people more than you fear God. There's a place for fear, but it's not to fear people. There's something far worse than death, and that is disloyalty to God. And so again, the question is, who do you trust? Where is your confidence? Is it in this life, or is your confidence in God? Because He is the one that can redeem the body and give eternal life to the soul. Finally, in verses 29 through 31, he again says not to fear. And here it's rooted in this analogy of sparrows sold for a penny, and not one will fall to the ground. An interesting point on that verse in light of our study in Bible class this morning is that word fall there can sometimes have the meaning of simply landing. And so it might not, and it's hard to know from the context here, it might mean that they're not going to die without God knowing, or it might mean that every time the bird lands, God is aware of it. That something as insignificant as a bird landing on the ground, God knows even that. And that certainly goes along with the idea of your hairs being numbered, God knowing even that. And it's in that context he says, don't fear, you're far more valuable than sparrows are. If God cares so deeply about sparrows, He cares even more deeply for His own. And all three times He says not to fear, really what He's saying is put your trust, put your confidence in God. That's what confession is about. Putting confidence in God rather than confidence in this life, rather than fearing man. And in their day, like I said, they were receiving persecution at the hands of the state, at the hands of religion, at the hands of even their family. And now I would suggest to you that it's exactly the same. We've been spoiled by a long period of religious freedom and peace, which may or may not have been as peaceful as we think that it was. But it's not much longer that that will continue. The one thing in our world that's not protected by political correctness right now is Christianity. We have a target, we're fair game, and they attack us verbally with whatever they want to say. And if you profess faith, you're mocked as small-minded. And if you're a business person who takes a moral stand, you may be sued and run out of business and called a hate monger. And it's only getting worse. Who knows how long it will be before physical persecution becomes a part of our reality? And the question is the same for us as it was for them. Do we stand with Christ or do we stand with the world? That's what confession is about. Not just standing here in a building full of people that agree with you already, but looking in the eye of someone who will put you to death or run you out of business or take your money in your home or just mock you and say, yes, I believe in Jesus. It costs us something to confess Christ, and it's going to cost more every day for us to do so. And it's not just saying, Lord, Lord. It's not just confessing Him in word, but it's confessing Him in deed as well, as Paul said in Titus 1. It's owning Him as Master and Lord and letting everyone in our lives know it. And we may lose friends and we may lose family. We may lose our work or our influence or our status. We may be mocked. We may be sued. We may be arrested or beaten or killed. But what Jesus says is confess Him and trust God. The worst thing they can possibly do is take your life away. But your confession is in the one who has the power to give life. And it's a life that can never be taken. There is great cost in discipleship. When you are the disciple of one who stands against everything the world stands for, and you have to acknowledge Him in that world that stands for everything that He is against, there is cost in discipleship. And Jesus goes on to say that we have to make sure our priorities are straight in this regard. He says, I've not come to bring peace, but a sword. And there's going to be conflict even within your own family. And the passage that was read, the parallel account in Luke, it's even stronger and more shocking there where Jesus says to hate your family to love Him. Of course, Jesus doesn't mean hate in a way that would violate honoring your parents or loving your spouse. And the Bible makes it clear that if you're married to an unbeliever, you don't hate them because they're an unbeliever. What he's talking about is this distinction, that this level of love, that your commitment to Christ is so great that it takes such a priority over everything else that by comparison it's as if it were hate. That if the decision were to come to make a choice between family and Christ, your loyalty would solely and only be with Jesus. And notice Jesus says here at the outset that he's not come to bring peace but a sword. I don't know if you've ever thought about that outside of this context, but that's a shocking kind of thing for Jesus to say. After all, the Messiah was said to be a prince of peace, and when the angels came to the shepherds on the hillside in Luke chapter 2, they declared peace on earth. Or you might think of Zechariah chapter 9, if you want to flip over there, Zechariah chapter 9. And verses 9 and 10 that make an even stronger statement of the peace that the Messiah would bring. Zechariah chapter 9, beginning in verse 9, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be cut off, and he will speak peace to the nations, and his rule shall be from sea to sea, and from the river to the ends of the earth." Here is this person that is coming that is so humble he'll ride on a donkey's colt, who will get rid of chariots and horses and bows, and will speak peace and bring all the nations together. And even here in Matthew chapter 10, when he sends the disciples out, he speaks of the peace that the disciples will bring to the house that is receptive of them, up in verse 13. And now all of a sudden he says, "I've not come to bring peace, I've come to bring a sword." And what you have to understand is what the word peace means in its context. Peace isn't just the absence of fighting. That's a nice thing. That's what we think of when we think of peace. But that's not the peace that Jesus is talking about. What Jesus is talking about when he talks about peace on this earth is a restored relationship with God. He's talking about real peace, true peace. That's what he brings to mankind. But in the midst of trying to bring that kind of peace to mankind, there's going to be conflict, because not everyone's going to accept the real peace that Jesus brings. So there will be conflict. There will be a lack of peace in that sense as he tries to bring the truer, greater peace. As long as there are people who refuse to submit to God, following the Prince of Peace is going to be a way of conflict. Jesus isn't saying that his purpose here is to poison family relationships. That's not what Jesus is getting at all. But that he brings a division between those who respond to his mission and those who reject his mission. It's a conflict of loyalties. And Jesus is saying that following him must take precedence over everything. And when he puts it in these terms, he makes it clear that he's talking about everything. I mean, there is nothing more important in the ancient world than family. Family wasn't then the way that it is now, where if you have an older family member that is just inconvenient, not that they literally can't take care of themselves, they're just inconvenient, you stick them away in a home somewhere so you don't have to worry about it. You have a pregnancy you're not interested in, so you just get rid of that child. That's not the way it was in the ancient world. Family was as important as it got. And Jesus says, "You must put me first," even when the call of family conflicts with my call. It's a willingness to put him first when persecution would take you away from your family. That's another side of it I haven't thought of that much. I think about, you know, if your family says don't follow Jesus and Jesus says follow me, there's a conflict, you follow Jesus. But there probably was a temptation for some of the early Christians who were about to be taken from their family because of their impending death. And they think about their wife being left alone. They think about their poor, blind child being left alone. And they say, well, maybe I should do something so that I can stay with them. No, even in that situation, Family must not come before loyalty to Christ. And it is severe language that Jesus uses here. But Jesus, again, is eager to drive away those who are uncommitted and draw true disciples to himself. Jesus doesn't want a Christianity that's filled with this landscape of half-built towers and nominal Christians that speaks to hypocrisy more than anything else. Jesus says unless he has the number one priority, he's not been given his rightful place. We've got to make our priorities right and put Jesus above everything else. Finally, Jesus says, whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Jesus last talks then about taking up the cross. And when Jesus talks about taking up the cross, what he's talking about is self-denial. He uses the same phrase in his call to disciples in Matthew chapter 16 and in Luke chapter 9, where he says, if anyone wants to be my disciple, let him deny himself and take up a cross. Those two things go side by side. And it is something of a bewildering demand. Jesus isn't calling us to a mild form of asceticism where, like a diet, we give up something for a little bit of time. He's not calling us to be weakened warriors for Christ. Jesus is saying that we must renounce our right to life. We must renounce our rights as we understand them, that our desires and our hopes and our aims and ambitions and plans and goals must all be put to death for His sake. It's a call to a true sense of values, a reminder that we're faced with a fundamental choice of where our true allegiance is. What it means is that at every moment and every day, we are to say no to self and yes to God. We are to dethrone self from our hearts and enthrone once, finally, and for all God there. We are to obliterate self is the dominant principle of life, and make God the ruling principle, the ruling passion of life. That doesn't go well in our culture, because our culture worships self. Our culture elevates self above everything else. In fact, selfishness has kind of become its own religion in our country. That's foreign to the Gospels. My rights, my privileges, my entitlements. Jesus doesn't care about any of that. He says all of that must be set aside. All of that must be put to death for His sake. And so He says, take up this cross. And it's significant that in the later call to deny self and take up a cross in Matthew chapter 16 comes right after Peter's confession. You remember Peter confesses, "You're the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus says, "That's right. Now what this means is I'm going to go die on a cross." And Peter says, "Oh no, that's never going to happen." He confesses Christ, but then immediately denies what it means for Christ to be Christ because he didn't understand. And Jesus goes on to say, "No, not only am I going to be crucified, but you must be crucified as well." This is why Peter had to come to terms with the sort of Messiah that Jesus was going to be, and why we must come to terms with that as well. Because if we don't understand that Jesus is a crucified Christ, then we will refuse to accept the fact that we must be crucified Christians. And this is where that so-called health and wealth gospel falls on its face. And anything else that we want to turn Christianity into other than this. Anything short of crucified Christians following a crucified Christ is not Christianity. We must take a cross. And it's not necessarily a literal wooden cross, although it was in some cases for early Christians, but it's very much a real cross. We must really crucify self. We must really deny self. And they understood exactly what this meant. It's not this the way we use this term to mean something that's, you know, inconvenient or we don't like it very much. I have this cross to bear, and what we're talking about is, you know, we don't like pizza or something ridiculous. When they saw a cross, when they heard about a cross, they understood what it was. When someone from one of their villages, the Roman soldiers came in and they put a cross on that guy's back and he went walking down that road carrying that cross, they knew exactly what that meant. It was a one-way journey. They would never see him again. That's what the cross is for Christians. It is the utmost in self-denial. It's not bearing up under a difficulty. It's not being inconvenienced by something. It's not facing adversity. It is deliberately dying to self. And in Luke 9, Jesus says, take up that cross daily. It's not just great moments of sacrifice. It's not just the grand things that we can muster up all our faith for. Someone barges into the building and says, confess Jesus or I'll kill you all. We can muster up the faith for that one grand thing. But in the menial daily aspects of life, can we truly deny self continually? That's what Jesus calls us to. You see, taking up a cross isn't something that's a one-time event. It's not something that can be finished. You know, you get it out of the way and then you're done with that. Taking up the cross is a lifelong pursuit. And that is the ultimate of the cost of discipleship. What does it cost to be a Christian? Well, it costs a whole lot. You must be ready to face death for Jesus and confirm your faith in Him. You must make Jesus first above everything else, even your own family, even what's most important to you. You must take up the cross and deny self at every turn. There was a bumper sticker that was going around for a while. I haven't seen it in a while. But it said, try Jesus. Now, on the one hand, that sounds kind of nice, doesn't it? Try Jesus. You might like him. That idea is foreign to discipleship. Jesus isn't something you dabble in. Jesus isn't something you experiment with. Trying Jesus, try him on for size, see if it fits, see if you like it. That's what happens when you have no idea of the cost of discipleship. No one who truly understands what being a Christian is about, both the positive and the apparently negative, no one who understands that is going to dabble with Jesus. You don't just try him out. You're a disciple or you're not. You're committed or you're not. You're a Christian or you're not. That's the cost of discipleship. And we need to understand that for ourselves, and we need to understand that for our teaching as well. And so even this morning, we offer the invitation to anyone who needs to make something right in their lives, or if you need to come to Christ for the first time and put Him on in baptism. We urge you not merely to come to Him and to be saved, but to understand what that means, to count the cost of discipleship when you come to Him, to know truly what you're getting yourself in for, at least as well as you can at this point. And if you are committed to Him, if you are willing to confess Him, not just here in front of friends, but even when your life hangs in the balance, then we would be thrilled to baptize you into His death. If there's any way that we can help you this morning, won't you come while we stand and sing?